This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
This week, we have definitely got a bit of a sci-fi theme going. We're going to kick off with Dune Drifter. Then we're going to move on to 2046 Chronicle. Our short shot this week is Exile, and we're going to round off with a bit of Bridget Nielsen and Craig Fairbrass in Terminal Force. So without any further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Dune Drifter. In the midst of a galactic war, a fighter pilot is shot down and crash lands on a desolate planet where she must try to survive and escape. Okay, this is bare bones plotting, really, Rich. It's not something, well, it is something we've seen before, things like Enemy Mine, also the film that, do you remember the short, the Batman Dead End one?
Oh, I know exactly what you're going to say. Yeah. You're going to mention Sandy Cholera, aren't you?
Sandy Cholera, who did a similar film.
Hunter Prey.
Hunter Prey, that was the one I'm thinking of. Yeah, so we've been down this road before, but this looks great. It's funny enough, when I looked it up on Amazon, because I saw, you know, I looked through all the sort of upcoming titles and I saw Dune Drifter and I thought, oh, here we go. This is going to be an asylum pick, sort of doing their usual mock bluster in the wake of Dune, you know, because it wasn't long after the trailer for Dune had dropped. So I'm thinking that's what it was going to be. And then when I checked it out, I thought, oh, hang on a minute. This is directed by the guys who did Night Shooters. And I was suddenly a lot more interested because they did a damn good job on that film. I think they do a very good job with this for the most part. There are one or two areas which let it down. The shaky cam elements for me didn't work. It was messy. But for the most part, I thought this was really good. The props they use, you know, the sets are really good. You know, the spaceships have a real sort of like lived in feel to them. They're clunky and chunky. You know, there's something tangible there that they can work with. The exterior shot's not so good, obviously. You know, it's not so much of a budget for the actual space battle and stuff, but I thought that worked really well anyway. Let's hear your thoughts, Rich.
I'm just sort of backtracking on the space battle stuff. I thought that was some of the best stuff in the
film. It was really, it had a good feel of like Battlestar Galactica to it. You know, the idea of like what you're seeing is it's at a distance. You know, it had distance to it. It had depth, which was interesting.
Yeah, for me, it felt like, say, although it comes from Mark Price, who's previously done, say, Night Shooters, but he seems to explore lots of different genres. He doesn't just stick to one particular style of movie. So he started with the zombie movie Colin in 2008. And his last film that came out was A Fistful of Lead, a Western. He's done various things. Night Shooters is the only one of his films I'd seen previously, and I was very impressed with it. This one for me was more of a slog, I'll be honest. I couldn't really get into it. It played like a high-end Star Wars fan film, and I don't say this is a bad thing. The space battles, as I just mentioned, which take part is the first 23 minutes of the movie, essentially, is in space. I thought was really, you know, very good effects and stuff. The scenario of the crash landing and trying to survive and then deal with threat and get off the planet and all that sort of thing. Hunter Prey came to mind, the Sandy Cholera, so just as it did for you, which also had fan film origins, because that was a guy who made, he made like Superman films and stuff, I think, Sandy Collar, before he did.
Well, the one he was mainly known for was the Batman Dead End one, wasn't it?
Because, sorry, Batman Dead End. That was
because that brought in like the Predator and sort of xenomorph alien into the mix, as well as the Joker and things. So yeah.
So that film was very much about prosthetics, you know, creature makeup.
It was his calling card. Yeah, look what I can do, sort of thing. Yeah.
Whereas this film has similar things going on, but the aliens that they're fighting are dressed just the same as we are, basically. There's no alien makeup as such. I think there might be a little bit in one moment or two. But the other film that mainly came to mind, because it reminded me of Star Wars with the space battles, you know, even the sound effects they use and the shoot and the explosions and everything is all very Star Wars. There was a short film in 2016 called Rebel Scum, which was about less than 10 minutes long, which seemed to have basically the same kind of structure as this movie, but that was about, you know, a rebellion pilot crash landing on Hoth and, you know, meeting, you know, some, you know, antagonists, you know, opposites in war. Have you seen that one?
I did manage to catch that earlier. I can see where you're coming from with that, but I still think this was a lot more accomplished.
Well, that is fair. Yeah, I mean, plus I didn't actually like Rebel Scum that much, but I think maybe it's this kind of movie, you know, this kind of trapped in a trapped in a desolate landscape, trying to survive kind of thing. And, you know, I'm not sure if I'd be the right person to watch The Martian with Matt Damon, for example, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just not really my thing. Although saying that, you know, the structure of the film is quite paced, I would say. Mm-hmm. So you get the battle sequence stuff, and then you get the stuff in the tent where the two people, the two people have crashed. And then there's the bit where they go out into the world, you know, some lovely location work.
Yeah, shot on location in Iceland.
Was it? Okay, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, because that some of those places just looked incredible. Mm. Then you get a bit of action, which was quite unexpected. I didn't see that coming. Some quite, well, not as good as Night Shooters, but, you know, pretty well handled.
Considering both people are wearing like space suits, I think we get a damn good fight out of the two of them. You know, I thought, you know, having to wear these sort of cumbersome costumes and still deliver something which was, you know, coherent and, you know, painful to look at.
Yeah, I don't know too much about the background of the movie, but I know that it was impacted by coronavirus. Mm-hmm. The production of the film was not entirely complete when it was all kicking off. So I don't know what had to change. There are, I believe, interviews with the director out there talking about what they had, you know, how they had to work around the situation the ongoing situation as of recording to get the film complete and out there. The poster design that is on the key art on the cover and stuff that Four Digital Media are using is very different to the original poster.
Yeah,
it's a lot flashier and sort of a bit more generic, really. The original poster is actually quite rough looking. You know, so it sort of portrays more. It shows more of the
It's low budget roots kind of thing.
Low budget roots. It definitely feels like it's a movie that would easily fit around sort of, you know, Star Wars, you know, so I think Star Wars fans would get a lot out of it, although I don't think the poster with that Dune,
the issue for me is that because they call it Dune Drifter and the way they've, you know, the style of the writing, it's emphasis on the word Dune, and the way it's written is to make it fit into the, you know, the syntax of the film Dune, both films, you know, basically. When there's no dunes in the bloody film, you know, it's a volcanic Iceland, basically. I don't know if there were original, you know, the different title.
Not as far as I'm aware. No, right. I think it was all as the original posters now are called Dune Drifter. It's just
maybe they had a different location originally planned to shoot in, you know, maybe a desert setting and then end up going to Iceland, you know, for whatever reason. Who knows? But
that makes sense.
Yeah, no,
I didn't quite get the title myself, yeah. I'll be honest.
It doesn't quite fit. But it's a great little film for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. What are you going to score it?
I'm gonna have to go a middling 5 out of 10, I'm afraid.
Wow. Okay, a 5 out of 10 from you, a stonking 8 from me. This was right up my street. It really was. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So yeah, very different opinions for Dune Drifter. I thoroughly enjoyed it with an 8, which not so much with a 5. Check it out anyway.
I'm wrong. Yeah. Check it out.
Check out the trailer. See what you think. It's in the footnotes. Our next review is Chronicle 2067. In the near future, the Earth's oxygen supply has been severely depleted, leading to just one city on one continent to be still operational. Scientists there have been working on a time travel solution, but it leads to unexpected results. So Rich, this is a Australian production starring Cody Smith-McPhee and one of my favorite actors, Ryan Quanten. Cody Smith-McPhee plays Ethan White, who's just a sort of typical sort of workaround guy, until one day he's pulled up to the head office with his best mate Jude, and let in on the secret that they've been doing these sorts of time travel experiments, and a strange message has come back from far in the future saying, "Send through Ethan White." So this looks great. This really does look great. It's got a great premise. That opening bit with the world spinning and the, you know, the narration of the sort of newscasters, which I usually hate. You know, I hate newscasters in films. It never sounds right. But just the information they're sort of passing out, and as they do, you see the sort of, you know, the changes to the Earth. It's kind of scary. You know, if you're a bit of an eco warrior, you know, it's a scary sort of outcome or outlook that they have. It poses a very interesting puzzle, you know, as all good time travel movies should. A bit of a sort of weird paradox thing going on. And, you know, for the most part, it's a two-hander, just Cody Smith-McPhee and Ryan Quanten doing a lot of the lifting. And I think they do a really good job. So what do you think?
Yeah, I echo a lot of your sentiments there, a lot of the comments that you've made. I mean, it's a spectacular looking film. Again, it's a film that really knows how to use its budget. It's clearly not been made with a, you know, Hollywood blockbuster budget, because a lot of the scenes are taking place in very a handful of sets, essentially.
Yeah.
So we've got like the Ethan's apartment and the apartment where he grew up, and then a couple of scenes. There's the lab where the time travel device is, and there's the future version of that, and then there's some out exterior stuff. And that's pretty much it. A lot of it's been enhanced with very impressive CGI. Cityscapes,
some matte paintings and things. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, I was sort of brought to mind of things like, you know, Logan's Run. You know, sort of the ending for Logan's Run, where you got like Washington all over run and stuff. I thought it did really, really good job.
And it's all the green. It's a very colourful film, so it's a very bleak future, very dark. You know, very pessimistic Blade Runner-ish and whatever as they often usually are. But at the same time, it's a very colourful film, and not just when they get to the future where sort of set it what it is. So they go 400 years into the future where things have started to get better, where the Earth has started to recover, where they are in 2067, there is no plant life. Everything has died at that point. But when they travel into the future, they see that's there. So that's why they're trying to connect with the future, because they think there is the solution to saving mankind is there. But, you know, when you're there, I mean, the greenery, the greens are just amazing. But as you say, largely a two-hander for a lot of the time. Ryan Quanson's character's kind of in there. You kind of think, well, why is he there? Why is he lingering around? Why is he suddenly, you know, travelled into the future as well.
It is interesting, isn't it? When he gets called up to the head office, you know, he works in the tunnels under the city for the most part, you know, and these guards come and sort of strong arm him upstairs, and then Ryan Quanton's character just sort of like ambles along with them. And everyone just takes it for granted that he's there.
So that was it. But everything becomes clear. It's very much, I thought, like a Twilight Zone kind of story, but like told over 2 hours. Yeah. It's very intriguing, very compelling. I liked the performances. I liked the little nuggets of information, the sort of the uncertainty and, you know, the questions and the riddles that they had to try and solve. And resolution, not so sure. I mean, with some of these things, it's like you can never be quite satisfied, maybe. But I thought it was pretty good. I can't think of another Australian movie like this that I've seen in terms of like a, you know, big. I know there have been a few, like The Osiris Child. We watched one called Occupation, didn't we?
Yeah, there's a sequel coming.
Rainfall, so. Occupation, yeah. Rainfall. But Occupation, it didn't feel like a big blockbuster. It was trying to do that, but it was, you know, it was very modest in, you know, what it was doing. This is just lavish, you know, but, you know, very using its budget really well, made in New South Wales, I think. The performances, really good. Brian Quanton, I wouldn't say I'm a fan because I haven't actually seen that much of his work, but he was. Yeah, I liked him. Cody Smith-McPhee was really good as the lead character, very unassuming. Sort of like you say, he's kind of worker ant kind of character, isn't he? It's like you're not like an unlikely hero kind of casting with him. The boss lady was trying to send them on. Who was sending him on the mission? Deborah Mailman, I think her name is. She was quite distinctive. She was quite good. I quite liked her. She stood out. And also the guy playing his dad, Aaron Glennon, as Richard White. Mm-hmm. I thought he was good because there's these mysteries about, because his dad, he wasn't around very much, and then he comes in on his 8th birthday and gives his son this present, which is basically
weird thing. Yeah.
This weird device that clamps itself to his wrist and makes him bleed, and
and the fact
he didn't have a very good relationship with his father. Yeah. Let's just say that.
There's one thing that we learn reasonably early on after he's sort of been sent to the future. There's something that happens. He makes this weird discovery, and it took me for ages to figure out what that actually meant. It didn't click with me for ages that thing was there, like from before, you know, that it was 400 years old in itself. I thought there's some sort of weird Schrodinger's cat thing going on. Yeah, but it turned out I was just overthinking things by quite a bit, which was weird. But it does sort of eventually sort of explain what had happened and why, you know, what was intended to happen. And why?
But the director Seth Larney has a background in visual effects, so that's pretty unsurprising when you when you consider, you know, what we've been saying about the quality of the visual dimension of the film. He's very experienced, been doing that since 2006, as far as I can tell, and worked in various other capacities before. He'd only made one feature prior to this called Tom Biro, which is like a action drama, which sounds looks very intriguing. But before that, a few short films and stuff, which I'm very interested to check out. But there's been quite a gap. I mean, the short films he made around between 2008 and 2011. So I presume his style has changed quite a bit since then. But I mean, I can't wait. I mean, I hope this guy gets signed up for another film of this, you know,
this budget, because he clearly knows
he clearly knows what he's doing, how to work a budget, and how to make film not only look good, but, you know, be something that, you know, the audiences can connect with. because I wouldn't say I got emotional in it, but I think there's definitely, I think there's definitely some emotional dimensions to it that you know, are very well handled. You know, specifically the sort of father son sort of stuff and the friendship between
Ethan that works and, well. But also, I mean, for me, the bit that broke me was when his fiance gets the box at the end.
Yeah,
I thought that was really well done as well. Nice touch. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. You know, it's the way the film does end. You know, it has a sort of, you know, quite an optimistic ending. But it's still going to be weird for him turning up and going, "Oh hi, yeah, I'm from the past." You know, it's going to be weird. But anyway, how are you going to score this one, Rich?
A high 7 out of 10 from me.
Yeah, this definitely gets a 7 out of 10. I think it could have been trimmed a little bit. You know, it comes in at what, 1 hour 50, I think.
Yeah, it's nearly, it is nearly 2 hours.
Yeah.
Probably, I mean, probably, but there's probably about 5 or 6 minutes of visual effects. So you said about 1 hour and 45 minutes long.
But it is very, very well done. It's definitely worth checking out. So 2 sevens for
Chronicle 2067.
Thank you. Our short shot this week is Exile. A father and daughter discover someone or something has raided their stores and endeavor to track it down. I think that's basically all you need to know about this, Rich. It's very short and sweet, about 8 minutes, I believe. And it's, you know, it's nothing we haven't seen before. We've been down this route with all the mutants and things like that. The things with Robbie Amell, for example.
Yeah. What was that one we watched? What was that short film we watched about the young girl and her dad in the house? And they were sort of keeping... they were keeping it all boarded up or whatever, and then, you know, her dad dies or something, and then she's got to go out into the world. Do you remember that one?
I kind of remember that one, yeah.
I can't remember what it was called, but it was on Dust, as was this, recently.
But here, you know, okay, it's nothing, you know, the concept isn't new. The, you know, the sort of world building even isn't particularly new. The execution is impeccable for this. The actual filmmaking is superb. And the creature, shall we call him, the Exile, is superbly realized. You know, they do an awesome job of adding emotion and desperation to this character.
It's all in the eyes and stuff.
Eyes are superb. And you know that, you know, the connection between the daughter and the Exile, it works incredibly well. It works as a metaphor for, you know, today's America as well. You know, it definitely does that. But yeah, the you know, the I don't know what you call it, the animation, the choreography, whatever you want to call it, that they use for this thing is just so well done. And of everything we've watched this weekend, you know, and the things we covered over the past two episodes, this is by far my favorite.
Wow. And that's high praise indeed. This is by complete coincidence. Last week we covered a film about a father and a daughter, and this week's film is about a father and a daughter, although they don't develop the characters in the same way. This is a much shorter film.
This is a chase, also, isn't it?
It is a chase, and it's also unlike Hammerdown, which was the previous film we previously. This is very much a film that's a proof of concept. You can just tell there's not really much exposition, there's not much attempt at resolution. It's sort of a moment in time, a bit like when we watched Skywatch, I think it was the one that Jude Law appeared in. You know, it's an introduction, and then a kind of a world building thing happens, and it's called sort of like teases you to want more. So that's kind of how this one plays out. But yeah, it's the impact of the encounter, I would say, between the sheriff, I think he's a sheriff, and his daughter.
Yeah, he's some sort of law official, isn't he?
Yeah, and meet and encountering the Exile. But this action just kicks in completely unexpectedly, and it's really well executed. A fight, not even, well, is it a fight scene? I don't know, because he's kind of it's the exile kind of moving and getting the weapon.
Yeah,
and that's right.
Yeah, it's the way he gets the weapon, it's the way he unloads it, and you know, that it's just done so quickly and just so smoothly. It just looks like, yeah, this is something it's been programmed to do time, you know, and it's done time and time again. It's just done really well.
Yeah, I think it's, it's an actor, but I think it's been like mocap element on it, and they've, overlaid it with visual effects, but very subtly done. It's obvious that it's visual effects because it couldn't look that way in real life or anything. There's no way to emulate that, but it looks quite naturalistic in the way they've managed to do it. And so the film looks really good.
So the director for this, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, Neil somebody.
It is Mark Freeberg.
There you go. So you told director. You. Yeah, it's Mark, it's told you. But he, his track record is with like high-end, sort of very quality visual sort of adverts, isn't it? That's his sort of forte. And he does bring that to this, the way it's sort of lit and shot is a top quality.
And apparently one of his credits is Transformers Age of Extinction, director's mentee. He's studied under
Michael Bay
is what I take from that.
Yeah,
so, I don't know. That's quite an unusual mentee. That's an unusual credit, anyway. But
he must have looked at those Transformers designs and thought, okay, so let's keep it simple, so people can actually sort of see the, have a sort of an emotional connection to them. So
yeah, his background seems to be very much in drama more than visual effects kind of driven films. I think if you can get that good, if you can get that solid mix of the drama with the visual effects, a bit like what they did with Code 8, and again, a film that was very much a proof of it was very much a proof of concept, which they elaborated into a feature. I do hope that Exile does become a feature. I think there's a lot of potential to explore there, although I do wonder if it might just be like, do like the Chappie thing or something.
Yeah, or another Code 8 or another New Mutants.
District 9, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. It could be a bit, it might be hard to find some new ground, but I'd still be very interested to see where they might take the story.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. This is available on Mark's own website, but it's free to watch. So we'll put the links into the footnotes. Check it out.
It's also on YouTube.
It is on YouTube as well.
On Dust. Right,
there you go. Of course, it's on Dust, isn't it? Yeah. Yes, so we'll put a link in to the footnotes. Definitely check it out. It's 8 minutes. You will not regret it. Our DTV throwback this week is Terminal Force. Legend says that the sacred crystal is the source for all life and was created at the beginning of time. Kyla has sought the crystal to use its powers for himself, and he takes the crystal after smashing the defenders of the planet Centauria. But there is another identical crystal on Earth, and Ladera, played by Bridget Nielsen, heads there to get it before the evil Kyla. She finds that Jed has taken the crystal from its hiding place, but Victor and his inexhaustible hitmen want it for money. Let's leave it there. That's from IMDb. I think it's a reasonably succinct description of what the hell's going on here, Rich. I like parts of this, dislike other parts of it. I think the opening 20 minutes are great, and then it gets a bit middling, and then sort of finishes reasonably strong. The opening thing, it reminds me, I know we sort of talked about, it reminded you of Masters of the Universe.
Yes.
You did mention that. For me, it reminded me of more of Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, okay. I've never seen that, so I can't.
Never? Oh, my God. Okay. You've never seen Battle Beyond the Stars?
Wasn't that written by John Sayles?
It certainly was, yes. Roger Corman effort. We'll get into that another time. But so the night, you know, the night battle scenes reminded me of the night battle scenes in that particular film. Mm-hmm. So we not only have Bridget Nielsen, we also have Craig Fairbrass as the basically the leader of this group from on the planet Centauria, holding out against these invaders as they try to get this crystal. We get a cameo from Sam Raimi, of all people, as this sort of like toady, sort of wormy guy, sort of wanting to sort of give up and surrender to the baddies just to save his own neck.
And it's not just a quick moment either. It's like a full-on scene.
Oh, yeah, it goes on, yeah. But Craig Fairbrass, I mean, I thought it was superb seeing him in this, to be quite honest, and I thought he did a really good job. Weird seeing him with like a mullet, you know, but yeah, he stands up quite well with Bridget Nielsen, so that all really worked for me. But the rest of it on the planet Earth, I confess, Rich, I fell asleep in the middle of this. Yeah, okay. I woke up not knowing what the hell was going on with these Italian hitmen kind of thing going on. Very strange. So I throw this over to you.
I saw this when it first came out on Medusa Video in, what would it have been, 1995. It came out, and it was originally called Galaxis in the States, so it was Terminal Force over here and various other territories, I think. The guy William Mesa, who directed it, I believe has a lot of visual effects in his background. You know, he's done everything. Oh, Fluminense, he's done tons of stuff from more recently, let's say, things like Deep Blue Sea. Mm-hmm. What's it, Jack Reacher, Never Go Back and stuff. But you know, he's Outland, Fugitive, Last Samurai. He's a visual effects guy primarily. He's not he's not a film director. He's only got 4 directorial credits. This one being the first. He also later did a Mark Dacascos film called DNA. This one really didn't do a huge amount for me at the time, but it's always kind of one of those that I remember as distinctly of the period, of the time.
It sure is. And going back and watching, especially being a Medusa film as well.
Yeah, and going back and watching it, I do get that Masters of the Universe vibe. You know, I probably didn't get it then, but you know, you watch it, and also Beastmaster 2. There was a lot of science fiction films being made around that time about, we haven't got that much money to actually do it in space.
So we'll send it on Earth. Yeah.
We'll bring it to space. Which, you know, in all fairness, that was kind of the setup of many classics like The Terminator and stuff anyway, although not out of space, but you know, the future. Let's bring the battle here. So the Terminator is a big influence on this, as is Star Wars. You mentioned Battle Beyond the Stars, so I can't, but that was a Star Wars ripoff anyway, wasn't it, as well? So
yeah, cross between Star Wars and the Magnificent Seven, basically.
Yeah, that's it. So this, you know, it starts out, it's a sci-fi battle movie with mystical elements. So we've got like a crystal, as you mentioned in the synopsis, that they're trying to get hold of. And you can't help but liken it to things recently, like the Infinity War, and think about, you know, the bad guy in this is kind of a poor man's Thanos.
Poor man's Thanos.
Played by Richard Mole, who's best known for his comedic turns in the sitcom Night Court, but he's done loads of other bits and stuff. But he's a very statuesque guy, and he's sort of hamming it up in this.
Oh, yes. He is pure gammon in this. You know, there's some really horrible lines in it. It's like, oh, I'm beginning to like it here. Wah-ha-ha-ha, all this sort of stuff. It's like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, I thought he was very much like Andrew Dvorak. He was playing it in the same way, like film. The Wishmaster kind of thing. That opening sequence is mainly focused on Craig Fairbrass, and that he has that great scene with Sam Raimi. Bridget Nielsen is not in the film really at this point, she's off. So I think she comes in after Craig Fairbrass has gone, essentially, for the most part.
Yeah, one scene together, basically, yeah.
Yeah. So it's unusual to see her in, you know, the lead role. I mean, this was around the time she was cast in quite a few DTV movies. She did, she'd established herself in the 80s with things like Cobra and Rocky IV.
Beverly Hills Cop 2. Stallone.
Beverly Hills Cop 2, yeah, she was the villain. Yeah. And yeah, and then sort of, you know, she's gone, end up in, you know, sort of B-movie territory. She ended up making films with Sonny Chiba and all sorts. But this was kind of, this is kind of a memorable starring role for her. She doesn't get to do a huge amount with it. It's, it is kind of like a an Arnold Schwarzenegger hero, you know, role in the sort of simplest sense. She doesn't really develop much character, if you see what I mean. She's kind of one note. It's more about the human guy who she teams up with, who sort of gets more of the, you know, character going on as he sort of tries to, he has to sort of carry it a bit more. There's a, the reference, the Terminator stuff kind of flows through it. There's even a scene which is the Terminator police station scene.
Yeah.
It's done in sort of a quick throwaway way, but they do basically do the same sort of idea.
Don't they kill off one of the main characters on that bit as well?
I think they might do, yeah. I mean, that might have been one where one of the detectives might have got...
Yeah, the black detective's partner. And...
Yeah, so I quite liked them. I mean, they were introduced quite early on and they, you know, we keep returning to those characters. They're really unnecessary, but it's quite fun to get some of their lines and, you know, he's really angry all the time and stuff and sort of gets to say some quite funny stuff. It's like... you're telling me some bullshit episode of Star Trek, son, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
When he's interviewing the guy who basically got hold of the crystal. So the reason, what's Bridget Nielsen's character's name?
Ladera.
So the reason she has come to Earth to find him is because he picked up this crystal. He's like an adventurer sort of dealing in special goods, kind of stuff. So that's why he's got like the mob after him and stuff, because he's, you know, he owes it to them or something like that.
Yeah, because the thing with that character, I mean, you know, they want him to be this sort of like, you know, Indiana Jones kind of guy who's, you know, he's robbed Paul to pay Peter kind of thing. You know, he's sort of always one step ahead of his debtors. But the guy... He looks like he spends his whole day sat behind a computer. There's no rough edges to him at all. You know what I mean? There's nothing rough and ready about this guy. He is a pen pusher. You know.
No,
but the character's written
with Martin Cove.
Yeah, exactly. Character. Yeah,
I think that would have been much better.
Yeah. Instead, we got bloody what's his name from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Rick Moranis.
Yeah, a slightly more butch version of Rick Moranis.
Yeah, basically. I see what you're saying there. I do get what you're saying. At the end, it's quite funny. At the end of the film, you've got the big climax between the alien hero and villain. But they have to throw in an exploding helicopter, sort of an arbitrary exploding helicopter, to make it a big moment. So it's a great helicopter explosion there, but it is, you know, it's conveniently timed at the moment that she's going to stop him, because really, what would he do? Just sort of, it'd be like a real anticlimax. It's just like, I've defeated you. That's it.
Yeah.
So what can we do? Let's throw in a helicopter explosion.
Throw in a helicopter. Yeah. Almost good value.
I think it's a fun film, very much of its time, very, you know, well worth checking out. And where else are you going to see a film with Craig Fairbrass and Sam Raimi sharing a scene, some cool sort of stop motion, old fashioned space battle kind of stuff, and Bridget Nielsen running around trying to keep
her costume from exploding. Yeah. But there is one other, I mean, you know, we mentioned sort of the Terminator sort of scene, you know, the police headquarters thing, but there's also other bits like where these cyborgs sort of morph from like children into full-grown robots and things, which I thought was quite good as well.
Yeah, there's a bit of a, do you remember the movie Screamers?
Oh yes, yeah, that's what really reminded me of as well, yeah.
The morphing, because morphing was kind of the thing at this point. This is couple of years after Terminator 2. Everyone's got to do morphing now.
That's it.
But I don't think that works very well. But the sort of stop motion thing was quite charming, I thought, of the droid kind of thing. It was sort of Harryhausen throwback kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is on Amazon Prime, as usual. We like sort of digging through the bargain basement that is Amazon Prime's back catalogue.
We're not endorsing Amazon Prime or any other provider.
Yeah, it just so happens that they happen to have a lot of these eclectic films from our past that we want to.
Unfortunately, Netflix doesn't have as many.
It doesn't. No. Somebody pointed out that Netflix, you know, their horror collection, for example, only has like two films which are pre-2000. So, which is pretty harsh, really, isn't it? You know, as our friend David Wayne sort of points out to his customers, you know, when they sort of turn around and say, well, what have you got that Netflix doesn't? And he sort of turns around and says, well, about 5,000 more films, actually. You know, Netflix has got quite a limited sort of vocabulary, sort of library, unfortunately. They could really do with it bumping that up a bit. Whereas Amazon Prime is good for sort of older stuff, basically, and more sort of outlandish things. So, yeah, things like Cannibal Ferox and things like that you can find on Prime. Anyway, we digress again. It'll be there. It's there. Go find it. We'll put the trailer in the footnotes, see what you think of it, check it out. And
one last note.
Oh, go on.
No, one last note, I'll say, if anyone's wondering why Sam Raimi's in this, it's because William Misa, the director, was the visual effects supervisor on Darkman and Army of Darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that would have been quite late in his career, because he'd have done Evil Dead 1 and 2 by then, wouldn't he? As well as Darkman, as you say.
Yeah.
So he's quite an established director by that point.
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah. Army of Darkness was 1992, and this was made in 1995.
Yeah. So he's done his Evil Dead trilogy. He's done Darkman. You know, Spider-Man's just around the corner, basically. And yet here he is, sort of rubbing shoulders with Craig Fairbrass on the set.
It's usually his brother Ted who's doing the acting.
That's right. Yeah,
you don't often usually turned up in this sort of thing. Acting. Yeah.
Check it out. Anyway. That is the end of the show. Thank you to Rich for joining me again this week.
No problem.
All the trailers will be in the footnotes, as well as the link to Exile, our short shot this week. Check us out on at the DTV Digest on both Twitter and Facebook, where you'll find the latest DTV charts and news about upcoming releases. So check us out. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again soon.
Listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.